Welcome back for another episode of Sea Control Asia Pacific, your serve of maritime security analysis with a side of think tank thug life. As always, I'm your host Natalie Sambi, coming to you from Perth, Western Australia, where I'm now research fellow at the Perth US Asia Centre. Today, I'll be talking to fellow Aussie Laura Spano, Arms Control Manager with the Centre for Armed Violence Reduction and Pacific Regional Coordinator for Control Arms. We kick off discussing small arms flows globally before focusing on the impacts of illicit arm flows into the South Pacific Islands, a region of great strategic importance to Australia. Today's episode is really about what happens when maritime security and border control are weak, creating a permissible environment for illegal activity. Laura explains the nexus between security and development and its impact in the South Pacific. But before we get into the thick of it, we'll be back after this short break. Take it away, Martha.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSEC is, and always will be, free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There's a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSEC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
Hi, and welcome back. Today we'll be talking a little bit about arms flows into the South Pacific and some curious developments in that sphere. Today, talking with me is Laura Spano. She's an Arms Control Manager with the Centre for Armed Violence Reduction, as well as Pacific Regional Coordinator for Control Arms. So in terms of the South Pacific, we'll be looking at countries like Papua New Guinea, Fiji, the Solomon Islands, New Caledonia. As I mentioned, it's a region of great strategic importance to Australia, particularly where the effects of UN frameworks like the Sustainable Development Goals are keenly felt. So today we'll be talking about the link between small arms, security and development. And without much further ado, let me introduce my guest, Laura. Thanks very much for making time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
Laura, let's start a little bit about you. So you're wearing a number of hats right now, as I mentioned, with the Centre for Armed Violence Reduction and for Control Arms. Tell us a little bit about your roles and what sparked your interest in these kinds of issues.
Yeah, certainly. So as you mentioned, I do work for the Centre for Armed Violence Reduction, and I mainly focus on arms control issues in the Pacific because we are the Secretariat of the Pacific Small Arms Action Group. And in doing so, we act as the Regional Coordinator for Control Arms, which is a global civil society coalition advocating for a strong arms trade treaty. I always like the question of how did you get into this, because I think it's very fascinating for everyone involved, because everyone has a different story. My background is in atrocity prevention and conflict prevention, specifically looking at UN peace and security frameworks and negotiations. And I actually got into this because I'd been on exchange in Canada and really saw how much students were getting involved, and I wanted practical experience. I came home, I had jet lag, couldn't sleep, so I decided to watch Hotel Rwanda. The next minute, as you do, of course. And the next minute, I had an internship in Rwanda the following semester, moved to Rwanda, dabbled in work in atrocity prevention there for 2 years before moving to New York, where I worked at the UN headquarters for a civil society organisation that links the UN with civil society, and I mainly focused on government engagement on UN peace and security frameworks. So mobilising the political will to prevent and hold mass atrocities, genocide, and then more recently looking at the intergovernmental negotiations on the Sustainable Development Goals.
Which, of course, are the successes to the Millennium Development Goals as well.
Yes. A big part was looking at how the Millennium Development Goals had failed, particularly with failed states, and arguing for why it's so important of linking peace, security and development, which I'm sure we'll talk about more today. And somehow dabbled a little bit in Colombia with an interest in looking at integration of child soldiers post-conflict, and then found my way back to my homeland in a region that I'm not as familiar with prior to working on these issues, but very familiar with using UN frameworks such as the Arms Trade Treaty and the Sustainable Development Goals to prevent conflict and atrocities.
Wow, so it sounds like you've done a lot of work. And I mean, just in addition, I'd like to add in terms of where you've lived around the world, not only Rwanda, but South Africa, Kenya, DRC, you've worked in Armenia, China, Venezuela, Colombia, Lebanon, Brazil, and the US. Have I left anything off?
Canada. No, I think that's covered most of it. Yeah.
So, I mean, with that kind of global experience, I mean, you've had your eye on arms control for a while. Let's just take a macro view of what's happening. Can you set the scene for us? What's the state of play at the moment for small arms flows worldwide?
Yeah, sure. So I think when we're looking at small arms flows, we have to distinguish between legal transfers of weapons and illicit flows. There is a misconception that the arms trade is mainly terrorist groups,
sure,
and countries such as North Korea and Syria. But actually, a majority of governments play a role in importing and exporting and in the arms industry. For example, 74% of arms exporters is from five countries alone, the US holding the majority with 31%, followed by, no surprise, Russia, China, France, Germany. And 60% of the sales are to developing nations, but they're all legal transfers of weapons.
Laura, just to be clear, when people are talking about arms control, just as the layperson, are they usually talking about the legal or the illicit flows?
Arms control encompasses looking at both illicit and legal transfers, but it's looking at controlling weapons so they don't get diverted from the legal trade into the illicit trade. So it's looking at that point of diversion and trying to prevent that.
Are there many grey areas in this respect?
Yes and no. I think the idea is if you have the standards and practices in place, such as marking weapons appropriately, such as having a database with all the markings, such as licensing and controlling the weapons flows, you should be able to pinpoint when the weapon was last in a legal element, mm-hmm, and when it gets diverted into a illicit arena.
Right.
That's why we're looking at trying to implement these measures so there isn't that grey area where we can't distinguish whether it's legal or illicit. And then having said that, of course there are grey areas when it comes to transfers under the Arms Trade Treaty, which has been recently highlighted, for example, with criticism of the UK supplying Saudi Arabia with weapons that have been said to be used in war crimes in Yemen. I'm not going to necessarily say whether or not that is against the Arms Trade Treaty, although there are speculations it is, and that's where a grey area comes up. The Arms Trade Treaty is fairly young, and so actually understanding this position, and as long as they're adhering to the protocols under the Arms Trade Treaty and the UN Programme of Action, hopefully there is no reason for concern.
Yeah, certainly. Just now honing into the region, I've just got this interesting statistic here. It's the 2015 edition of the Global Burden of Armed Violence report states that 44% of all violent deaths are caused by firearms. And now that we're looking at flows, both illicit and legal, into the region, I just wanted you to talk a little bit about what some of the major impacts of armed flows into Cypriot countries, like into South Pacific states, has been.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we've seen globally the impact of flows of arms into Syria and Afghanistan. We know that arms prolong and escalate conflict. Luckily, in the Pacific, we haven't seen this as much. We've avoided what we call the AK-47 plague. However, having said that, we have seen what even a leak of small amounts of arms can do in the South Pacific, and we've seen this particularly in two cases with Papua New Guinea, We saw a proliferation of small arms. It escalated long-held ethnic tension, which hindered the access to healthcare and is still doing so, and educational facilities. We've seen destabilized democratic elections. And interestingly, although the Pacific as a whole is relatively stable and secure, PNG actually ranks as having the highest level of violence in urban centres in the world. And PNG police are really struggling to sort of control armed violence in the cities and organise gangs. And of course, this is then having a destabilising impact. We're seeing foreign investors reconsidering their activities in the country because the cost and demands for things like private security is becoming too high. And so we see both sort of an impact on the instability, but then the flow-on effects to that economically. Which also brings me to the case of the Solomon Islands, where we actually have seen leakage of about 1,000 weapons from the armed forces into the country, into civilian hands, as well as weapons flowing from Papua New Guinea into Solomon Islands. This led to about 200 deaths and about 100 child soldiers being recruited. And then had flow-on effects leading to a 25% reduction in the GDP, which is extremely high. And we have to put this into context. Pacific Islands do not have large populations, 100,000 people, 200,000 people. So when weapons flow into the country and get in the hands of civilians, even 1,000 weapons has a really devastating effect. And the reduction of a GDP and major industries closing like they did in the Solomon Islands has led to devastating effects across the entire country. And they're still trying to recuperate now from that, which happened back in the early start of this century.
Mm. That's interesting. And I note now, I mean, we mentioned quite a bit earlier about the Sustainable Development Goals. And I note that Goal 16 is about creating, you know, promoting a just, peace and inclusive society. That seems to be an SDG that's relevant in particular for our region. Can you talk a little bit about how the SDGs might be addressing some of these issues?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that goal 16, came out of an obvious failure of the Millennium Development Goals in fragile states. I mean, they only were able to achieve about 20% of Millennium Development Goals targets. And it's particularly important in the Pacific because sustainable development is a key issue. And we see now of negotiations from the Sustainable Development Goals that there is a link between peace, security and development. It's almost impossible to have any sustainable development if you don't have peace and security. And therefore, implementing and creating frameworks around the Sustainable Development Goals are hugely important because we need to have this preventative approach in the Pacific. If we don't have this preventative approach and we're not implementing these frameworks, we have weapons flowing in, we have devastating effects on sustainable development. And this also impacts wider than just the Pacific Islands. We've seen more and more discussion about climate change and security issues and the flow of potential refugees who are being impacted by rising sea level and what that's then going to mean for the region as well. So if we have all this compounding on sustainable development, then it's our region is not going to be as stable and secure as it has once been.
And certainly. In addition to those sustainable development goals that are encouraging development, in terms of on the arms control side, besides the ATT, what other kinds of instruments are there that can address the situation as well?
So there are a number of instruments, and we've seen the UN negotiate more and more of these over the last couple of years. The first one I think to mention would be the UN Programme of Action on Small Arms and Light Weapons. It's essentially a political commitment in which sets out a list of standards or provisions for states to have standardisation of processes and procedures when it comes to exporting, importing, marking of weapons, tracing of weapons. And although there is criticism towards how successful it's actually been, given that it is a political commitment, I think we could show that it has been quite influential, particularly in the Pacific region, who have come up with the NANDI framework, which is essentially a framework in which all Pacific states can adopt in order to improve their legislation for their arms control. And it has led to a model legislation and has led to a number of states in the Pacific adopting legislation that fills some of the gaps that were there prior, and also to standardise some of those procedures so they are tackling some of the vulnerabilities that were there before. As you mentioned, the Arms Trade Treaty is a big one. And then probably another one that I would mention would be the International Small Arms Control Standards. It's a number of standards that was designed by the UN basically to say that if you were to take on these standards when it comes to licensing of weapons, comes to exporting weapons, etc., you would then be following a number of UN arms control frameworks that are out there and essentially building a very comprehensive system for arms control. And slowly, more and more countries are adopting these, and particularly in the Pacific, they see these as extremely useful tools, given that there are capacity constraints, and this sort of lays it out there for them to use these.
Sure. So that's on the legislation side. Are there other areas, not only just in development, are there other areas, policy areas, that are complementary in order to be able to achieve this greater security and greater arms control?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of policy areas. A lot of two of the Pacific countries right now, for example, are going through security sector reform, and that is looking at both how to fill the legislative gaps, but also some of the policies surrounding women, peace and security, how to integrate their national frameworks on the 1325. There's also been, for example, the Australian White Defence Paper, which is a number of people have called for assistance from the Defence Force of Australia. There's been bilateral negotiations between different states. There's been regional frameworks and discussions around possible policies towards implementation of the Arms Trade Treaty. I mean, there's a number of discussions going on. The problem is that a lot of these discussions are happening over and over again because of these capacity gaps that we see, rather than implementing some of these policies.
I see. We'll come back to the Defence White Paper in a little bit. Now, given your wide experience around the world, I wanted you to just hone in on a few, what are the specific challenges of this kind of arms control in the South Pacific when, say, for instance, like you brought up countries earlier, like Libya, but also countries like the DRC. What is it about the South Pacific that makes it so challenging? Are there other issues and or cultural points or other kinds of conditions that make it unique?
Yeah, absolutely. When I came onto this position, I had a big learning curve because I did have to learn how to deal with a completely different environment to what I was used to before. That being some more hardline states where just getting the political will of states to believe in the possibility of some civilian protection was difficult. Coming from that challenging environment, I came to an environment in the South Pacific where generally the political will for these instruments of peace and security is there. There's no convincing that is needed, although I'll come to a case where we may need some work. But in general, most officials, most of the governments, they want to have these comprehensive frameworks. They want that security and safety so that they do have sustainable development. And I sort of mentioned already that the technical challenges of the Pacific, the capacity issues, then while the political will is there, it is almost impossible for them to actually be able to implement a lot of these UN frameworks, given that they have a vast ocean, which is almost impossible to patrol. They are small governments that are trying to implement large frameworks. There is insufficient infrastructure when we're talking about stockpile management and facilities. But there's also sort of a little bit of a worry with the Pacific because it is somewhat of a relatively peace and stable region. the region isn't as invested, and also the outside, the global sphere is not as invested in the region in terms of peace and security and actually putting in this preventative approach.
Right.
And the danger of that is that because we have so much gap in capacity and legislation at the moment, if all other regions were to, say, sign on to the arms trade treaty, then the Pacific would become vulnerable and perhaps a hotspot for arms dealers. This is, again, challenging when you mentioned that before that 44% of violent deaths is caused by firearms. In the Pacific, it's actually a relatively low number. Violence is caused by other means, not by firearms. However, in contrast, we actually have a very high rate of gender-based violence.
Indeed, I've heard that places like the Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea have extremely high rates of violence towards women.
Absolutely. And it's really concerning to us when we hear anecdotal stories where people say, well, why are firearms not a weapon of choice? Well, they're not a weapon of choice because bullets are too expensive to waste on a woman. And this is extremely concerning for us because...
So just to interject for a second, that's something that you've picked up when you've been in the region. Is that an attitude that's a pervasive attitude, or is that just some people saying that? Or
no, it's widespread attitude that firearms are not used against women because it's too expensive. That's why there are other weapons used. And, I mean, this is a concern for us because there is such widespread gender-based violence. If arms and ammunition were to flow illicitly into the region and they became more widely available, easier and cheaper to access, we can only imagine then what kind of violence we may see with ammunition now becoming cheaper to use. So this is a huge challenge to try and convince people of the need for a preventative approach as opposed to post-conflict approach.
No,
and just the last challenge with that that goes hand in hand with that is, while there is also a capacity gap with technical challenges, there's a capacity gap when it comes to political, the political sphere. You're looking at countries that only have four people working in their Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So their ability to engage in dialogue on arms control in the global sphere is near impossible. And they do the best job that they can, but because they're missing from a lot of the debates, a lot of the infrastructure is built without taking their situation, their context, their culture into consideration. And therefore there is questions around the utility of these frameworks when implementing them.
You know, I'm conscious as you are, being Australian, that quite often in the past, we, and probably to a lesser extent New Zealand, have been considered to be, you know, a helpful actor towards countries in the South Pacific, but also seen as acting in somewhat a colonial way. I think you wouldn't disagree with that. But in this sense, you know, it seems to me that there's a lot that Australia and other countries can do, particularly where representation in diplomacy, and if not supplementing technical knowledge, is concerned. In your opinion, like, what are the roles that countries like Australia can take, you know, bearing in mind, obviously, sensitivities of being an acting colonial, or the Australian Defence Force? I mean, can countries like Australia, let's say the United States, even ASEAN states, as we mentioned earlier, Russia and China, can we help or can we hurt the cause of arms control in the South Pacific?
That's an interesting question. I think when it comes to the Pacific region and disarmament and arms control issues, we are lucky that we do have a sense of consensus when it comes to actually wanting to implement these instruments. The challenge does become how do we balance out helping with becoming this sort of big brother and advising and telling the Pacific what they should and shouldn't do. And you do get some resistance when talking to some officials, but generally that they want the support and assistance, and where they want it is when it comes to the technical issues. Stay away from the political issues. Let's talk about how to improve stockpile management, for example. And we've seen Australia do this before, go into Papua New Guinea and help them assist with how to make sure that their armed forces weaponry is safe and secure. So there's one way we can actually help. Also, we can help in terms of working with regional bodies like the Pacific Island Forum and other regional groups who are a channel in a way of working collectively. In the region, it's much more about a collective approach rather than Australia and New Zealand coming in and sort of saying, this is what we're going to do. These bodies are well respected and also support the cause of arms control within the region. So working with those groups, I think, is something that countries can do. And then looking, I guess, outside of the region, I think some people question, for example, why Russia has this interest in giving weapons, for example, to Fiji. And we've seen more and more this interest, number of dialogue between the country. And the question is this it or will it go further? So in that respect, I think we're all sort of waiting to see where this goes, whether it could help or hurt us. And there has been also talk about looking at the comparison between, say, the Caribbean region and working with CARICOM, their regional body, who has been very effective in the negotiations with the Arms Trade Treaty, and perhaps having some lessons learnt or best practices for the Pacific who haven't been able to engage politically as much. And then vice versa, learning from the Caribbean, who has an incredibly high rate of murder with firearms, and how the Pacific, who doesn't, can then help the Caribbean. So it's more of a two-way process and on a more level field.
That's really interesting. I've heard places like Haiti are particularly prone to firearms violence as well.
Definitely, yes.
Well, that's very interesting as well. Look, it sounds like there's a lot of work to do, and no rest for the wicked, I guess.
That's right.
And so, look, Laura, thanks so much for such a comprehensive talk. It seems like there's even more to discuss in terms of the permissiveness of the maritime environment around South Pacific countries as enabling these kinds of illicit flows as well. So perhaps we'll have to come back and talk about that another day.
Absolutely.
Well, look, thanks so much for spilling your brain and sharing your knowledge about...
thank you.
Not
thank
at all.
Thank you for having me.
And before we sign out, I'm going to ask you a question out of left field and say if there are any recommended tunes that you have for some of our SimSec community. What's the kind of music that you like to listen to while you're working on these kinds of issues and doing your research?
Always a man with a guitar. Man. It doesn't matter the song.
Mm-hmm. All right, not a problem. Is there anyone lately that's been in your iTunes rotation?
Oh, putting me on the spot.
I am.
I'm really bad. You know what? I'm old fashioned. I go back to Matchbox 20 all the time.
Excellent. All right, we'll start with that, and we'll have to hit up your recommendations in the second round. Laura, thanks so much again. SimSec listeners, if you would like more work by Laura, you can follow her on Twitter at lspano, so that's L-S-P-A-N, sorry, let's do that again, at L-S-P-A-N-O-2-7. And of course, you can listen to the rest of our SimSec podcasts either following us at Twitter at SimSec or our website simsec.org. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating. And thanks so much for joining us again.